Golf Smarter number 219 for February 23, 2010.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The return of custom club maker Tom Wishon.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading the Golf Smarter podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Golf Smarter for members only. Once again, I wasn't able to cover everything I had planned in today's episode, so part two is next week, and it's a members only show. Make sure you take full advantage of 4 years of archives, a complete program every week, and exclusive discounts by joining Golf Smarter for members only at golfsmarter.com. Actually, stay tuned after the interview because I have a special offer if you're thinking about joining. The good news is that if you're hearing the show, the ship didn't sink. And my wife and I have returned from our week-long cruise down the western coast of Mexico. But because I only had 1 day before I had to go back on the road down to Phoenix, Scottsdale, I produced this show the week before I left on vacation. Which is to say, I had a wonderful time. And when we speak next week, I'll have some news and hopefully a new show to share with you about the Arizona adventure. Our guest today is an old friend of Golf Smarter, and it's so great that he's willing to come back on the show because he's opinionated, articulate, and generally right. Tom Wishon of Wishon Golf is an author of 9 books and one of the most outspoken and prominent custom club makers in the world today. His books, The Search for the Perfect Golf Club, The Search for the Perfect Driver, and The Right Sticks, are must-reads for anyone who's contemplating purchasing new clubs. Sure, there's technical information in there, but not so much that the average hacker can't learn some valuable insight into how to make an informed decision about your purchase. Welcome back to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Tom.
Thanks very much, Fred. I'm glad to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
Oh, are you kidding? You're one of our favorites. I think this is, like, the fourth time you've been on this show?
Yeah, no, it's fun. I enjoy talking about golf equipment, you know, from all the way from the physics and technology to the politics of it, even.
That's an interesting start. You've just thrown me a curveball. What do you mean by the politics of golf clubs?
all the things that go on under the current, you know, that are all part of the actual how do we make money off golf clubs part of the industry.
I see. You know. I see. And is there ongoing battles with the USGA and the RNA about club specifications?
Well, you know, there's no doubt that starting about, it's now 12, 13, 14 years ago, the members of the decision-making committees within the USGA, it seemed like there was more of what I'll kind of critically say a hawkish attitude where an awful lot of them begin to point fingers at the golf equipment industry and say, if we don't put handcuffs on you people, you're going to ruin this game. And so thus ensued a series of new equipment rules that started back in 1998 with a limit for the coefficient of restitution of the faces of clubs, and then went on from there to be a limit on the size of a club head, the limit to a length of the club head, a limit to the moment of inertia of the club head, or I should say length of the whole golf club is what I meant, a limit on the MOI of the club head, and now we've walked into this one with the change in the score lines because the USGA's powers that be just didn't like the fact that out on tour, guys who bombed it into the rough, you know, didn't seem to be getting penalized for having hit it offline, and they were, you know, still able to hit the ball in the green, make birdies out of the rough, and the USGA didn't like that. So, you know, here again, so there have been 5 major equipment rule changes, all of which place limits on the golf club designers in the last 12 years, you know, for this. And so it really has started, you know, to get to the point where it's had an effect on the companies, both in terms of how they run their businesses and where they're going to take their future design concepts to try and help golfers.
Do you think it's a case of the USGA saying, no, it's my ball, you can't play? or is there a conversation, is there a dialogue that goes on between the manufacturers and the USGA to try to find a happy medium to all of this?
Well, the USGA will tell you that they keep the doors open and that they do have a real dialogue from it. A lot of the people on the equipment side will say, that they just are turning a deaf ear to the golf equipment designers. That they'll accept the emails and letters and phone calls, but they don't really do much about it. For that, a lot of people within the equipment side have wanted there to be a committee within the USGA that actually included some representatives from the golf equipment industry, so that the equipment designers, and the companies could throw in their two cents worth, to have discussions about this. Because we all play the game too. We don't want to see it ruined, but we'd like to see the right decisions made, and we'd like to see the rules be very consistent, with respect to what we can and can't do. Clear definitions of what would have, a damaging effect on the integrity of the game and therefore what has to be controlled, versus ones that end up being self-policing in their nature and therefore don't really need to be brought in under a control situation. Or potentially saying, okay, I know you got a rule, envisioned here. Let's say, for example, you don't like the fact that the bomb and gouge players on the tour have an advantage over the short straight hitters in the fairway, so you want to be able to make the rough become more of a penalty than it has been. Okay, that's a good goal. Now let's all look at different ways that we can go about doing that. You guys have brought forth the idea that you want to change the configuration of the score lines so it makes it more inconsistent to hit shots into the green from the rough, or to be able to, make that rough be more of a penalty. How about if we take an approach where you say, grow the rough longer, taper the fairways in more narrow the further out it goes?
How about growing rough right in the middle of the fairway?
Well, that's not the point that came about with this, that a lot of us in the industry feel that the USGA completely missed, is the fact that if you go back 25, 30 years ago, the average clubhead speed on the PGA Tour with a driver was about 105 miles an hour, okay? Today, that average clubhead speed is about 113, 114. Okay, we all know from the physics of impact that each 1 mile an hour that you can increase clubhead speed with the driver, for example, you're going to get 2.8 more yards. So if the tour on average now is swinging the club 9 miles an hour faster, there you're looking at 25 more yards of distance, with this. And so the other thing that goes with this is those guys, as the clubhead speed with the driver goes up, clubhead speed with the irons goes up too. And what used to be somewhat penalizing rough at, let's say, 2.5 or 3 inches in length, now is not that penalizing to someone with, let's say, a 90-mile-an-hour 5-iron clubhead speed, as opposed to, let's say, 80 miles an hour 25, 30 years ago. So if you go back in, and this is one that's kind of funny. I know if you watch some of the old golf shows on the Golf Channel and you see All-Star Golf, things that were televised golf back in the 70s or 60s, and you look at the golf courses they play, these guys get on the greens. The greens look, in 30 years ago, the greens look like frog hair today, the fringe, The fairways look like the first cut of rough. And this all came about. There was a change, conscious change out there back in the late 70s and 80s when the tour players began to gripe and moan about hitting flyers from the fairway. And so the tour went out and they mowed greens down to next to nothing and speeds went up to like 13 on the stimp meter. Fairways went down to a half inch and the ball would roll forever, when you hit it off a tee. But the rough was never upgraded because the players didn't want it upgraded. Made the game more difficult. So here we sit, with basically the same rough on the tours on average, that we had 30 years ago, but players who have 10 miles an hour more clubhead speed. So the guys that bomb at 310 get it out into the rough, and now with their higher clubhead speed, they got no problems hitting 8 iron, 7 iron, 6 iron out of the rough on the greens. So a lot of us in the industry, when we heard the USGA wanted to do something about bomb and gouge, and when we heard that the USGA wanted to go change score lines to do this, we said, no. All you're going to do if you make a score line change is you're going to make things very inconsistent. Sometimes a player's going to hit a shot out of the rough and he's going to see a flyer that blows over the green. Other times he's going to hit it on the green, it's going to stop just fine. If you really want the rough to be a consistent more penalty, grow it longer. And I'll never forget a phone conversation I had with Dick Ruggie, where I was really trying to push this point because I really didn't want to see a scoreline configuration change because it wasn't going to be consistent, with this. And he came back to me when I had suggested growing the rough longer, and he says, "Oh, Tom," he said, you know, it costs more money to grow the rough longer and groom courses like that. Not to mention, what about the inconvenience to the members of the golf courses that are hosting the tournaments for those weeks leading up? You know, they'd have a really difficult time playing their own golf course for fun out of rough like that. And I was just flabbergasted that he used that type of a comment back to me. In essence, it made me sort of think that, okay, here's lip service, and we're going to go ahead and do what we want to do anyway.
Absolutely. And I'm flabbergasted, too, because to me it just seems like they are an shouldn't the governing body be an advocate for the athlete and not the course, not the, you know, the playing field?
Well, the main
reason...
it seems
like that they always are just making rules to favor the golf course and not the golfer.
Yeah, well, you know, this gets into things that are too difficult to prove, and they end up just being accusations of a sensational nature. You know, when you get in there and you say, let's look at all the golf courses and clubs that the members of the high-ups committees in the USGA are members of. An awful lot of these host major tournaments. Gee, I guess it would cost these clubs a lot of money if all of a sudden their golf course were outmoded and the tournaments had to go to other brand-new courses that were built longer and all that. You know, so... you know, is there a point in there where some of these people are acting in their own self-interest to keep these tournaments, and keep the prestige up at their clubs? Been a lot of people in the industry who've had that as one opinion for some of these actions that have been taken by the USGA, you know, within this whole context of all these equipment rule limits that have been put on over the last few years. You know, it one of the best things to me that happened, you know, that kind of proved to me, or at least it gave me a statement that maybe the USGA tended to act before, you know, they thought, was back when the coefficient of restitution rule was pushed through. Okay, we look at how was it done, okay? Number of people from the tour started to complain to the USGA and say, man, you got to do something about these titanium drivers. They hit it so far, it's going to ruin the game, and all these golf courses are going to be rendered obsolete. So the USGA, you know, decided that, well, we need to have a limit on distance, and what's the best way to do it? Let's do it through coefficient of restitution on the face. Okay, that's fine. It's a viable physics entity that dictates exactly, you know, the potential for distance of a clubhead design. But what they did not go out and investigate by having somebody make all sorts of different drivers with different CORs of 790, 800, 810, 820, 840, up to as high as it could be done. They didn't do that and go out and hit test them to find out the real distance increases that came from these things. They didn't look at this from the basis of saying, you know, if somebody hits it 10 yards further, they now have to deliver the club face about a half degree more accurately to keep that in the play. You know, with this. And so, boom, they set this limit at 0.830 simply because of all the titanium drivers that had been submitted to them for conformity rulings. Once they developed a COR test, they found that the highest COR at that time in the late 90s that had been submitted to them for regular conformity testing was 0.830. So they said, we're setting the line right here. We're not doing any testing to determine any effects of this. Boom, this is where the rule is. Well, the Royal and Ancient of St. Andrews, you know, looked at this and they said, well, wait. We need to look at this a little bit more. USGA basically said, no, this is the rule. We're pushing it through. And the RNA did something they hadn't done for about 60 years and said, no, we're not going to adopt this rule in 1998. And they didn't. And it was really interesting. That was around the same time, you may remember, that Callaway Golf came out with a driver model that was called the ERC2. And they intentionally created this driver with a COR of like 0.855, 0.860, and basically were thumbing their noses at the USGA to say, we're going to sell this high COR driver and let the market decide what they want to buy. And we're also going to be making 830 COR drivers and keep it all conforming there for those golfers who want that. You know, and so off it went. Well, out over in Europe, that year, 1998, there was no COR limit. On the European PGA Tour. And so at the beginning of that 1998 season over on the European Tour, there were something like 54 players who began the year using the ERC2 with its super high COR. At the end of that season, four of those players were still using that driver. 50 of them had given it up. Why? Because they found that, yeah, they hit it a little further, but it became a little more difficult to keep it in the fairway. Because if you take, you know, and you send a shot off at about 3 degrees off at an angle, and that shot goes 270 yards, it may stay in the fairway. But if it goes 280 yards, it might now be in the rough at this point. So it self-policed itself, really, over on the European Tour, and that was a good laboratory field test for this. And basically what happened was no player won a tournament on the European Tour that year using one of these very high COR drivers, and no player who had been very low on the money list all of a sudden jumped way up and was making more money because he was using this and hitting the ball further. It self-policed itself. And so there the RNA was, you know, saying, look, we don't think we need this rule. And so they didn't adopt it. And then the USGA kept pressuring the RNA, saying, look, we can't be split on the rules. We got to both be in agreement. Boom, boom, boom. And all of a sudden the pressure came to bear. And the RNA, 10 years later, on January 1, 2008, finally caved into the USGA and said, okay, we'll adopt the rule. You know, but for 10 years over there, between 98 and 2008, anybody in any tournament could play any COR driver possible, and it didn't have a negative effect on the integrity of the game.
Here's what baffles me. You hear the USGA talking about for the integrity of the game, for the good of the game, and that there shouldn't be a set of rules for the amateurs and the pros. And yet it seems as if their reaction to creating these rules is based on probably less than half of 1% of all golfers.
Yep, absolutely.
It's all determined by, well, if these guys hit it 280 to 320 yards and then they can still get out of the rough, we got to change the rules.
Yep.
What about us? I mean, should there be a set of rules? You know, should there be a set of rules for the touring or for competition and for non-competitive players? No, of course not.
It's an interesting debate.
Yeah, right.
This is the whole thing, Fred, that they call bifurcation of the rules, okay? It exists in baseball. You know, in high school and college, you can use metal bats, but once you go to the major leagues, you got to use a wooden bat.
Right.
Okay, now that's mostly done in the interest of keeping pitchers alive, you know, because the ball comes off a metal bat a little faster than it does a wood bat, and with a pitcher 60 feet, 6 inches away, he might get his head knocked off with a metal bat in the major leagues with some of these, you know, hitters at that highest level. You know, so bifurcation exists right there.
So precedence has been set.
Yeah, it has been. You know, everybody in golf, you know, most of the powers that be in golf have never really wanted bifurcation. And I count me as one of those. I like the fact that even if I go out and play a fun round, you know, under the rules, that I'm playing under the same rules that, you know, everybody else is out on the big tour, you know. The traditional nature of the game appeals to that, to say, let's not split the rules, okay? Well, we've split them now, you know, because the irons and wedges that you and I will play for the next 10 years are different than the ones that the tour players have had to start using beginning January 1 this year.
Do they not see the hypocrisy in that? Do they not get it?
Well, what they were supposedly doing in this was they were being benevolent dictators in terms of saying, look, Joe, regular golfer, we don't want to force you in tough economic times to go out and spend $600 on a new set of irons and wedges, you know, just to have these new score lines. So we're going to allow all you regular golfers to go until 2020 at the least, playing your old stuff, and then we'll take a look at it again and determine when you have to make the change, you know. And so everything is staggered, you know. But where this all came about, and it's kind of interesting when you look at this, one of the main reasons that the USGA completely threw out the concept of trying to use longer rough or tapered fairways as a way to penalize the bomb and gouge players is, quite frankly, because they have no jurisdiction over the grooming of the courses for PGA Tour events. There's only one tournament each year, actually two tournaments each year, that the USGA and the RNA have the full total say over the tournament that the tour players play in, and that's the US Open and the British Open. Okay, and they, you know, so if they were to have chosen to say, let's grow the rough as a way to penalize players who hit it out there in the rough, they would have had to lobby the PGA Tour to get them to buy into this concept and get the tour then to go to, you know, and do this for all of the regular tour events. And quite frankly, I think USGA didn't think that they could do this. Now, at the same token, the way they pulled this off to make all the tour players now be forced to use clubs with the new scorelines this year, they had to go lobby the tour and say, look, we think you got a problem. We'd like to see you, you know, make a little bit more of a penalty for these long hitters in the rough. So will you take this rule of the new scorelines and will you adopt it as a, quote, condition of competition, unquote, for 2010? And the USGA and the PGA Tour, they don't want any kind of political smell or any kind of potential controversy between them and the USGA. They want this all to just be a happy, you know, flowers in the air type of relationship. And so they said, yeah, we'll do that. And they had a lot of gripes from the tour players. They said, wait a minute, don't we get some time, you know, to think about this, try this out? Why don't you do it in 2011? No, we're pushing it through in 2010. Boom, there it went through. You know, and so now you got this situation where, you know, the players have made the change. Most of them realize it's a non-issue. They can still stop the ball when they need to on the green, but they don't like the fact that it's very inconsistent, and they don't really know when they're going to catch a flyer versus, you know, catch a normal shot coming out of the rough. Well, they're all just going to have to get used to that because it's the same way for all of them in that respect. Tour players notoriously dislike change. You know, out there. And this is change, you know, for them. So a number of them have made comments. Then you had this really strange situation where all of a sudden somebody figured out that the USGA hadn't seen the loophole for the old Ping I-2 wedges that were grandfathered in to be perpetually conforming because of a lawsuit settlement. And so there you have a situation that if you take any golf equipment company today, and if they go out and design a new set of wedges and they duplicate the score lines that were in that 1980s era Ping I-2, you submit that club to the USGA or the RNA, they're going to rule that thing non-conforming now so fast it'll make your head spin.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is the situation that happened, what, down in San Diego with Phil Mickelson?
And
he was accused of cheating. Right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Because these guys saw this loophole. They said, well, you know, technically this wedge should not be conforming because its lines do not satisfy the new scoreline rule configurations. But because this was part of a lawsuit settlement back in the 1980s, it is okay. And so therefore, I think I have an advantage and I'll go find one of these old wedges and use it. Okay. Well, under the spirit of the rules, they shouldn't be used. You know, because technically the shape of that groove does not conform to what the players are supposed to be playing on tour right now. But it is okay because way back in the 1980s, this was part of a lawsuit settlement to prevent this whole disagreement between Ping and the USGA from going to court and having it cost the USGA tens of millions of dollars in a ruling for this. So the USGA caved in back in the 80s, said, okay, all these irons that you've made so far, Ping, we're going to grandfather them. They're good forever. And now it ran into this. Now, don't you think that there should have been somebody in the USGA or the PGA Tour who kind of a few months ago or a year ago said, hey, guys, what are we going to do about this lawsuit grandfather settlement that allowed these I-2s? Technically, those are going to be okay.
They were probably told.
Thought about it.
Yeah, they probably said, just shut up. If they don't know, don't bring it up. Hopefully, they won't either.
And now what they've done is they put John Solheim of Ping in a really tough situation. Hmm. You know, he's the guy now who holds the cards on this thing. He knows it's not right that those players use a wedge that's not technically conforming. But at the same token, he's got a company where his father worked his tail off to try and prove what he, you know, was doing was right, and his father, you know, and their attorneys negotiated this settlement. So I can see this situation where, you know, regular golfers are going to look at this and say, John Solheim's a jerk, you know, for not going to the USGA and the PGA Tour and saying, oh, go ahead and take these wedges off and rule them non-conforming, you know. And that's not right, you know, because John Solheim is a very honorable man and a really super good guy who loves this game down deep in his heart more than anyone, you know, with this. But he's got himself now stuck in a rock and a hard place. At the same token,
and he didn't do anything to bring it on himself.
No, he didn't. You know, and at the same token, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, John Solheim now holds the cards. Mm-hmm. He's got some power here over the USGA and the R&A and the PGA Tour, so he should be able to negotiate something, you know, good for his company out of it. What? There's no way that they can sit there and say, okay, Ping, in return for saying that these old wedges are non-conforming now, we'll let you go out and design drivers that have a COR of 840. Well, they can't do that. That's not fair. You know, what else are they going to do? Give him money? You know, I mean, this is a real tough situation out there. You know, I mean, technically it's one where because these wedges, these Ping wedges, are only conforming because of a lawsuit settlement, all these players should just sit down and use practical common sense and say, okay, we understand the spirit of the scoreline rule. We understand that these wedges are kind of a weird loophole because they're a part of a settlement. They don't really have grooves that are what we should be playing with. So on our own, we'll be the gentleman that we're supposed to be in this game, and we won't use them. That's, you know, I mean, that's really what should happen. But no, in today's society where you've got a handful of people who want to try and use every possible loophole to their advantage, you're going to have a handful of players who are going to say, yeah, I can use that wedge, so I'm going to use it.
Do you know the anatomy of how it came about that Mickelson realized that he had a club that he could use and it was legal, how that came about?
I don't know that.
Okay.
I mean, at these points, I think, you know, there's always going to be a lot of people, you know, some people are going to figure things out sooner than others. Some people are a little, you know, a little sharper knife in the drawer.
Yeah.
Somebody out there, you know, came along and said, hey, you know what? These I2 wedges have the old type score lines, and they're okay because they were grandfathered in by a, you know, a lawsuit settlement.
And when you talk about score lines, you're talking about the grooves.
The shape of the groove
the
and
shape
the shape of
the
top edges, yeah.
And what does this mean to us, to the rest
golfers?
Of the...
Yeah. Nothing. Really nothing. You know, I mean, the USGA did a wonderful job when they did this whole gigantic groove research study, you know, two years and 3 years ago. I mean, it was a massively long published report, and they did a very good job of going through a lot of things and other things in the test. They, you know, they tried to do the best they could to simulate rough. There's a lot of debates in there saying they didn't do that well, but what the heck. They did a lot of research, let's put it that way. You know, in that report, they basically said from the fairway, these new grooves are no different than the old grooves. It's only in the rough that they're different. And it's basically only when you're using a urethane-covered ball, you know, for this. So if you look at most, you know, most average golfers, you know, an awful high percentage of them use Sirlin covered balls, for which it'd make no difference. Then you bring in the sheer fact that under physics, the higher the club head speed, the more backspin you get anyway. And most golfers don't have very high club head speeds. You know, so the difference you're looking at for Joe average golfer is nil. It really is, you know, for this. And the USGA tried to do the new scoreline configuration in a way that would affect the elite players, but not have that much of an effect on the average player. And they did an okay job with that. The problem is that for a lot of us who, you know, have, you know, who are career physicists in the game and designers and all that, we look at this and just say, look, if your goal was to stop bomb and gouge and make the rough a half shot penalty, you can't do that by changing score lines because you open the door to where the shots coming off those faces are going to be very inconsistent. You know, golfers are not going to be able to predict what's happening at that high level on the tour. Grow the rough really long to where somebody looks at that ball down there 4.5 inches in the grass and they know they can't hit 7-iron out of there. They'll take the wedge out, knock it up the fairway, and at that point, the rough is a half-shot penalty. You've achieved what you wanted. But that's not the way that the USGA chose to go.
Right. Because you know, they were looking more at the high-end tournament player than everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing they didn't really do, they didn't really investigate from a production side, how difficult is it going to be for your golf club companies to manufacture your irons and wedges with these new score lines?
Oh, interesting.
It's incredibly difficult to do. And not only that, all of us now are paying anywhere from 5 to 15% more for our irons and wedges because the foundries to be able to make these things, these new score lines, so that they will conform, it's more expensive. It's taking them more time. you know, to do this, and they're charging us golf club companies more money for the same club heads with the new scorelines.
And this is not a period of time in the economic history of the golf industry to start adding expense to the golfer.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I certainly don't like the fact that I got to pay that much more for the same head, you know, that I had designed and was producing for 2, 3, 4 years.
And the other thing it seems like that they're not taking into account is that the golfers of the 60s and 70s and the golfers of today are completely different beings. I mean, they're much more of athletes, professional athletes, than they are just golfers.
Absolutely. That's the reason why you've seen the club head speed increase out on tour over the
last
several years.
Why don't they make a rule that you have to go out and get drunk the night before a tournament?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, man. Unbelievable. Tom, I want to talk more to you about club fitting and what the industry is doing. Could you can we do another show about that, and we'll put that up for next week's program? Well, thanks so much. And again, it's wishongolf.com to check out what Tom's doing. If you want to find more about custom club fitters in your area and whatnot, he's a great resource to find that out. And we're going to talk more about custom club fitting in next episode. Tom Wishon, Wishon Golf, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next week.
My pleasure, Fred. Best to you.
This guy knows what he's talking about, doesn't he? All right, how'd you like to have an autographed copy of Tom's book, The Right Sticks? Here's the offer. Join Golf Smarter for members only before March 1st, 2010, and I'll be happy to send you one. Otherwise, you can purchase a copy of all three of his books in the Golfer's Mart section of golfsmarter.com. As we approach spring training for the new baseball season, we close with a quote from Hall of Fame baseball player George Brett, who responded to a reporter about his pro-am round with, "I was three over, one over a house, one over a patio, and one over a swimming pool." Next week for Members Only, part two with Tom Wishon, and this time we talk about custom club making and the value of having clubs made for your specifications. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or quotes, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.